Hello everyone, welcome to this edition of the FOSDEM. My name is Mehdi and I am a senior software developer at GitGuardian. Today I'm going to talk to you about implementing and managing feature flags in a Django application. First, let's talk a bit about GitGuardian. GitGuardian was founded in 2017. Basically, what we do is we automate secret detection in public and private repository. If you want some numbers, last year we scanned around 1 billion public commits on GitHub. We've detected in last year more than 2.5 million secrets. We are also the first GitHub application for security on GitHub Marketplace, and we scanned around 1.3 million private repositories from different VCSs. We are still growing as we raised 44 million last December, and we are currently around 60 employees with a research and development department around 40. We have two main products. The first one is the public monitoring, which is monitoring GitHub. You may have been alerted by this product if you have an open source repository or a public repository in which you have leaked a secret. You can use this product to monitor your repositories and be alerted in real time. The second one is the internal monitoring. The internal monitoring will enable you to plug in our solution to your VCS to monitor all your private repositories, either on GitHub, GitLab, or Bitbucket. It will enable you to find out if there are any leaks that have happened in the past or any leak that are happening. And also, we are trying to prevent you from leaking anything with pre-commit solutions and such. We also have a very cool open source project that I invite you to check on GitHub, which is called GG Shield. It's basically a CLI that you can use to scan either your repositories or even Docker images to find out if you have leaked anything in your layers. Let's talk a bit about the basics and why we actually needed feature flags at GitGuardian. At first, we were quite a small company and we did not have that many clients, so we did not really need any feature flags. But as we grew and started to need more active development and to try out a few things based on the feeling from our customers, we started to feel the need to use feature flags. So what are feature flags? Feature flags, in like the core use of it, are basically booleans that can be either true or false, and you can check them. You can check them with an if statement. Basically, that means that if it's true, you will either show something or hide something depending on the use you have, and you will be able to change things for your users. At GitGuardian, we started to have a really need for the feature flags during development and users. So those two are different usages for feature flags, and I'm going to present to you now the different usage. The first one was for development. During development, we don't want to have a branch on Git that is living for too long outside of the main branch base, because if we do that, that means that rebasing or merging or basically keeping up to date with the main branch is going to be a nightmare. So what we do is we create a feature flags that will hide this feature from our users and that we will only activate for the developers during the development. So it's very useful and it's very class. The second usage that we needed the feature flags for were A/B testing. Basically, activate and deactivate features or part of a features depending on what we wanted to try out for our users. For instance, a good example for A-B testing would be you have a new feature and you're not very sure about the user experience that you want to provide and how it's going to be used. So what you do is you create two versions for the same feature of the user experience, and you expose your users to either one or the other. And based on usage and based on the data you have gathered, you will be able to choose, for example, which one you're going to keep and which one you're going to drop. It's very, very interesting from a product point of view. The last usage are settings. Why settings? Because feature flag can also be more like settings or preferences. Basically, they are settings that we want to change on the fly, that will be able to change without redeploying the application. And it's very useful to try out a few things, to arrange some numbers for some clients, etc. So it's very, very, very interesting. Also, feature flags are easy for us to use at GitGuardian because basically we have a monolith application. Everything is inside the same repo, so if we want to activate something, it's very easy for us to do, and it's very useful. But if you're using microservices, you will have a harder time, because that means that if you want to activate and deactivate feature flags, either you will have to expose them from one microservice to the others, or that means that you will have to update the feature flags in every microservice. So very good for a monolith, a bit harder to maintain for a microservices oriented. You could say that basically what we want to do is sort of already covered by Django settings, but that's not really true, because as I said previously, Django settings are most of the time reading variables from the environment, and we wanted to be able to change them on the fly and without redeploying the application. That's why we tried out our first library, which is called Django Solo. So Django Solo works out of the box, pretty much did what we wanted, and we were very happy about it for quite a while. Basically, what it does is it exposes a singleton model that will have as columns your feature flags, or your preferences, or your setting, whichever you want to call them. So every time you want to add a feature flag, you will need to do a migration, which can be a bit cumbersome when you start to have quite a lot of them and you have to keep up to date. It's very nice. You can then change your feature flags from the admin. You can change it or from an endpoint that you have exposed. Very cool. If you want to link those feature flags to your users, you can do a foreign key and then code the logic. But as we started to want to move those feature flags closer to the users, we felt that the library was not enough and that we needed something else and something more without having to recode everything. But before talking about that, let's talk about what if you want to try out feature flags and you don't want everything, you don't want the library, you just want to try it out and figure it how it works. Basically, you can do the Pullman version with Django. You would create a model with a JSON field, and you can then, as soon as you have done the first migration, you can then dump almost everything with some validation into your field. So you will have the possibility to change your setting on the fly or an endpoint if you expose it. You can do that from the admin. And if you want to link it to a user, same as the previous one, you can link it with a foreign key. And that's very nice. You don't need any migration because everything is inside the same field. Very nice if you want to try it out before deciding to use a library which will do everything for you, or if you just want to play around it and understand a bit more how it works. As I said previously, the main feature which made us use Django Dynamic Preferences is the fact that you can use this and bind it to the users. We're not going to talk about this right now. It will be a bit later, but this is how we use Django Dynamics. Basically, you will have preferences that can be either Boolean, strings, integer, etc. They can be gathered into section. They have a name. They can have a default value. They can be required or not. Very, very useful. And Django Dynamics will register them into a global preference registry for the global ones. That means that you can register your preference into this registry, and then you can call and or import this registry from another part of your code and use it everywhere and have access to those preferences. Basically, it's the same sort of usage that you had with Django Solo, but it's a bit but the main difference is that instead of manipulating columns, you're adding rows every time you add a preference. So basically, we have everything that we wanted. We can update settings on the fly or via an API. This can be linked to the users. We're going to talk about it in a moment. And once the first migration has been done to integrate the migrations from the library, you can access it and you won't need any migration anymore for every preferences. So how can we use that and make it a bit more production ready? As I said, the main feature we wanted to use from this library is what is called the per instance preference model. What it does is that you can create a new model that you have to bind your model to the instance part. Basically, behind the scene, the library is binding the instance and doing like the migration, etc. And it's very, very nice because, for example, for us, our user model is the account model, and that means that once we bind it, for instance, for all the preferences bound to the accounts, we can access them with account.preferences and then access the set preferences with the name as a dict. So it's very useful. Same as the global preferences, we need to, once we have the created and we have the migration for the model, we create a registry to which we can associate, for example, a manager to change the behavior of the preferences. We'll talk about that a bit later. Then we need to instantiate our registry. And then we can register your preferences. So same as the global one. But binding our preferences to our accounts was not the only improvement that we had from Django Solo. We also added quite a few things because we needed them. Let me talk about that. First, you have to know that Django Dynamic Preferences, out of the box, will not hit your database all the time. Basically, it will try to find your preference and the value inside the Django cache, and if it doesn't exist, then it will look into the database and set the value into the cache. We use for a cache with Django Cache Redis, because we have multiple servers and Redis can be shared, and we wanted to have something a bit faster because sometimes we had a few performance problems and the local cache was an easy solution to implement, and it's way faster than Redis. Well, way faster. It's around 10 times faster than Redis. But be careful because it is not burst automatically when the preferences change. So it can seem like a problem, but actually it's not really. We did set a time limit And also it's very useful because that means that when the value is read from the local cache, then the task or the functions calling to it will then not change it during their call, which is very useful for us. So basically to do that, what we did was we created a custom manager that we then added to the registry. We rewrote most of the methods, and that means that we are hitting the database a bit less, and the same for the network. As we were modifying the manager methods, we also used that to improve and optimize most of the requests to the database. And we also tweaked the creation from the preferences, because we have more than 150,000 users, which means that we don't really want to create all the times the associated preferences to every account, because that would be too many of them when most of the users are already using the default preferences. So to do that, what we created was a new model which enabled us to create preferences that would be null. They are able to be null. That means that if basically the method is, sorry, what it means is that basically if our users are having no value, then it doesn't matter. But it also means that if the value is the same as the default one, we would not create the object in the database. Another improvement that we made was we added a sense of hierarchy between the models and between the preferences, sorry. To do that, the first one we created was the notion and the property depends on, which means that a preference can depend on another. For instance, for a public API, we could have a quota, which then would depend on the feature flag and the preference that the public API is actually activated and enabled. We use that not on the preference model, but rather on the API that exposes this to the front end. Because we have an on-premise solution that gives the administrators from our clients about this some rights and some informations that it is not necessary to have this value if the feature flag above it or the feature flag it's depending on is not activated. The other one, the other modification that we added was that our accounts preferences have a property which is called AsGlobalPreferenceFallback. What it does is it means that the account preferences, if it's set to true, will be linked to a global preference with the same name. So if this preference is null, or if the preference does not exist for the account, because as I said previously, we don't create the preference for every account, then our code will fall back to the value set in the global preference before doing anything else. And same as before, every time you check either it's So every time we're getting a preference, what we do is we see if the value exists. If it exists, then we will hit either the local cache, the Django cache, or the database, whichever will answer first. If it's the database, obviously we're going to fill the cache. And if the value does not exist or is null in the account preferences, then we will hit the global preferences, which will have the same behavior. To sum up a bit about all the improvements that we added to the base of Django Dynamics, we improved a bit the management of the cache because of our stack. So it's a bit faster than Redis. It's clearly faster than the access to the database. It also minimized the number of requests made to either Redis or the database, as well as optimizing the request to the database if we ever need to do them. We adapted and created nullable preference to be able to not create all the preference at the same time and to have the mechanism of the fallback. We optimized the creation of the preferences to not overflow our database because we have so many users and we have quite a bit of preferences present in our code. And we added a notion of hierarchy between either the preferences and also the fallback from account preferences to the global preferences. Last but not least, how do we use them? How does our feature flags live? So as I explained previously, we have two types of feature flags. We use two types of feature flags. The first type are the settings that we want to be able to update on the fly, and those will never be removed, or at least until the feature is dead. But most of the time, we don't want to remove them. We want to be able to update them or to expose them to our clients on on-prem such that they can size their application. The other ones are the ones that we want to use to control the feature. So when we start to develop a new feature, what we do is we create the associated feature flag. We start to improve, and that means that we can merge quite often on the main branch without impacting our clients or our users. We work with it, we activate the feature flags in the development environment and sometimes for the quality team to check that everything is running smoothly. Once the feature is done, we then activate it in our SaaS product. It goes live to our clients. They can start to use it. Hopefully, we don't have any major bug when releasing it. But if we did, we still have the option to disable the feature flag at that point, restart the process of developing, debug, correct it, fix it, and release it again. Hopefully, we don't need that most of the time. When the feature has lived a few weeks in SaaS without any major problem, we then expose it to the admin area of the on-prem instances. We notify our clients that this new feature has been made available for the on-prem, and then, same as with the SaaS, we wait quite a bit, a few weeks, most of the time, more like a few months, to make sure that most of our clients should have switched it up. And at that point, we can remove the feature flag. And basically, it's a cleanup of the code. We remove every if in the code, remove the feature flag, and then the feature has been definitely added to the software. Thank you everyone for listening. If you have any question, we will have a session just afterwards to talk about this. If you have any interest in GitGuardian, I invite you to go and visit our website. If you are looking for a job, we are also hiring, and don't mind dropping us an email. And thank you very much for your attention. See you in a bit.
I think the main question that actually even I have is, what is the
downsides of the JSON approach.
Yeah, what is the downside of the JSON approach, and, yeah. and why go through all these layers and hoops? What is the advantage?
Yeah. So, well, I will answer it straight here. Broadcasting and streaming, and in like 3 minutes, that's it.
No, now is the good time.
Okay, now is the good time. Okay, so thank you. Sorry, guys. So the main downside of the JSON approach are all the sugar that you will have around the feature, basically, because that means that every time you will want to do something custom, like registering new preferences, add some control or some rights around it, if you want to expose it in the admin, if you want to do like quite a few things like that, you will need to recode basically most of what's in Django dynamic preferences.
It's
more about the JSON approach. I think is very useful if you want to try out and to do a proof of concept, then that you will actually need your feature flags and what they're used for. But if you want to go further, basically you may have to recode like most of the library, which, well, we do not really want to, I think.
So it's more quality of life on the side of the developer.
Yeah.
But it's not really bringing any, like, it's not really functional. It's more like all of these things that you can automate through having it
exactly.
centralized.
Exactly. Basically, most of the features are possible with the JSON, but you will have to do them yourselves, whereas they already exist in the library. So it's like, for instance, if you wanted to create a web application and you started with Flask, and then you start to have the problem of administration and you want an admin part, which is very strong, well, then maybe you should have used Django first. To me, it's the same sort of idea.
Okay. And this library, it's not yours. It's
something. No, it's not ours. We're only using it, and we have a few things that we have on our site that we would like to upstream, and hopefully we will have the time to do it. But mostly we use the library, and we made, I think, a few contributions in the past.
And it's a library which is Django specific, or it's something which is that you can use.
This library is Django specific, if I recall correctly.
Okay. So and through this library, that's where you're talking about automating the inclusion in the admin panel and
the rest. Yeah. Yeah. Everything is done. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Then I get it.
The library also manages section name, the default values. It's very handy.
Okay. All right. I think this was pretty much my main question. Thanks a lot for your answer and taking time to get through these details. Now the audience is going to be able to join very soon in this room and keep asking their questions. Thanks a lot, Mehdi, for your contribution, your talk, and I wish you a good end of FOSDEM. And see you soon.
Thank you very much. Thank you.